The average American, over the course of his or her lifetime, will spend approximately 3,860 hours looking for lost items. If you know me, you know I'll probably spend about 10,000 hours looking for lost items. I feel like I spend... And my wife shouts amen. I'm constantly like, if you ever see me frantic right before the message, it's because I can't, my Bible's missing or something else that I need to get up here, and just pray for me because I'm a mess. I jotted down a few of these other things, though, because they're going to interest you. For example, the average American over the course of your lifetime will spend about 2 weeks kissing people. Two whole weeks, night and day, 24 hours a day. Hopefully not consecutive. Like, hopefully it's broken up into two-minute spots. But, you know, some of the teenagers, they might just get done with half of it right in those few years. Sorry, Mom and Dad. But the average American will spend about 6 years eating. And there ain't nothing wrong with that. And I did a little extra calculation, and Chris Travis is going to spend about 3 months eating bacon. Okay, so that's... the average American spends about 115 days, night and day, 24 hours a day, 115 days laughing. That's pretty cool. I think the average everyday church participant spends about 300 days laughing, but you come to a good place. There's a dark side to this. The average American spends about 20 weeks of your life on hold. Every year, I heard someone say, with AT&T. Ugh. We're not AT&T haters here. I just saw that video podcast going out, and everyone working for AT&T is like, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. We're actually going to talk about work today, so we can delve into that. But you spend about 60 hours a year on hold listening to Muzak. Most of it is Michael Bolton, I think. But this is gross. This is like a gut punch to me because I think it's true of me, and it's probably true of most of us. The average American spends 9 years watching TV. Oh my gosh, at the end of my life, when I have not yet written the fantasy novel that I've been dreaming about writing, television will stand up as a witness against me. I mean, there's just no excuse for it. 9 years of television. Now, I mean, I'm not a hater of TV. TV's great. It's the novel of our day. And all kinds of TV's getting really cool. There's great stories and all that. But 9 years, I mean, that's like 10% of your life. That's incredible. You can't factor in sleep and work and stuff. It's like 30% of your life. It's just an incredible figure. This will interest you to know. Women spend, on average, about 136 days getting ready. Men spend about 46 days getting ready, which is why, gents, you stink. That's why you smell bad. And last but not least, and this is a rough average, the average American worker will spend about 76,000 hours on the job. Now, that's actually an estimate that we came up with, and it's pretty conservative, really. I mean, very conservative. We figured 40 hours a week, which is kind of short, for 50 weeks a year, which for some people is short, for 28 years, which for almost all of us is short, from when you were like, you know, 19 to when you were 58 or something like that, however we figured this out. Almost everyone works a lot longer than that, and most of us start working before that, and most of us work more than that, and some of us don't get vacations, and some of us work 7 days a week, so... Better estimates are closer to 90,000 hours a week, or maybe 100 or 110, but 76,000 hours sounds cool, so that's what we went with. And then, especially when you add into that all the things that I mean when I say work, and I really mean anything that you do to produce something, or to create order out of chaos, or to provide a service or a product is your work. So I'm not just including what you typically think about, out of the house, in the marketplace type work. I'm also including all that you do to prepare for work. So if you're a student in high school or college, that's part of your career path. That's part of your work. I'm also including any kind of work from home. So if you're a stay-at-home parent, that is your work to raise this little one, and it's incredibly important work. Or maybe you run some kind of business from home. There's work in the nonprofit sector. There's all kinds of work that people don't get paid for, but it's still work. You're still producing. So, for example, a lot of people post-retirement, they finally do get around to writing those memoirs they've been thinking about, or they're freer to volunteer with their church or babysit their grandkids or other people's kids or whatever, and you're still producing, you're still working, but you're not getting paid. Or maybe some of us, you're just independently wealthy, and so you're, you know, creating things or whatever, and maybe you don't have to make money. I want to be your friend if that's your situation, but no, maybe you don't have to make money, but you're still working. So especially when you include all that, all the phases of life, we spend a whole lot more time than 76,000 hours, but we each spend at least 76,000 hours. And that is a huge chunk of our lives. I mean, your life is your time. What is your life if it's not your time, if it's not the days? And so I think we'd all agree that I'd like to think that's not a throwaway. Like, I'd like to think that that's not just like the thing, I had to get through 76,000 hours of junk so that I could have the life that I want or so that I could live. I don't think any of us would be happy with just write it off. 76,000 hours, just cross it off. It's unfulfilling. It's meaningless. I didn't accomplish anything. It didn't make a difference. I think we'd all say we'd really want some kind of satisfaction or fulfillment to come from this huge portion of our lives. But that's really where the problem comes in, because people are unsatisfied in their work. I mean, the recent poll is that Americans, about half of American respondents to a poll said that they were satisfied with their work. Under half. Now, that's a two-decade low. 2 decades ago, it was like two-thirds. And that doesn't include all the people that aren't working. And the people that aren't working, you know, your job right now is looking for a job, and you're not satisfied with that work. And satisfied, I mean, that's a pretty low bar, right? The question wasn't like, how many people are thrilled with their work? How many people are doing what you dream about doing? How many people feel like you're living your strengths and you're satisfied with what you're doing? It was how many people were satisfied with their work, and less than half were. And I really resonate with that personally, because when I look back over my long and not illustrious career of hundreds, I feel like hundreds, but certainly dozens of odd jobs, I was very often unsatisfied with the work that I was doing. I might like this or that about it, but there was always a thing or two that I would have gladly changed, and sometimes jobs I just plain hated. And that's something that I think all of us experience. Now, I actually had to write these down because I was trying to remember all the jobs that I've had, and it took me like a while to think through because I just went job hopping for several years of my life, and there's no way I could remember them on the spot. So I just want to share some of the jobs that I've had. My first job ever was a paper route. I don't even think they have those anymore. You rode your bike around, and it was actually kind of a racket where you would like throw newspapers up on people's yards and then come around later and collect. Like, and they'd send kids around to collect. So they never asked if people wanted the newspapers. You just gave them to them, and that was acceptable loss, however many people didn't pay. Then you'd come around later with like your cute little brother, if you were me, and try to get them to pay for the newspaper that they never really asked for. So that was my first job. Then I tutored students. I did a lot of academic type stuff. I tutored students all through high school and college in math and English and reading and that sort of thing. I worked at gobs of restaurants. I mean, gobs. I worked at the Busy Bee Deluxe Bar and Grill. I worked at the Ground Round. I worked at Perkins, which is one of those 24 hours type places, like kind of like a Denny's. I worked there third shift, which that is what it is. I worked at Skyline Chili, TGI Fridays, and many, many, many others. In restaurants, I worked as a dishwasher, I worked as a line cook, a prep cook, a server, a host, a busser, expediter, an assistant manager. I mean, I did every aspect of food industry at the local restaurant level. I also did some construction. I worked a couple years doing landscaping, mostly installation. The winters were the worst. The only thing you could do in winter is snow removal. We put plows on the trucks, or you can prune. We did a lot of pruning, which that's super fun. I did a bunch of different construction. My first real job in high school was I worked at a crew that was rehabilitating historic buildings in downtown Cincinnati. And the first two weeks of that job, they gave me a putty knife, and they were exposing brick walls. And my job was to scrape the loose plaster off of each brick, each individual brick. Like, after 2 weeks of that, I remember I came home after dark once, and I looked at my parents' lawn, and it looked like a brick. It looked like a brick with plaster on it. My eyes were going nuts. The hardest physical job I ever had was I worked as a laborer on a brick crew that was building a parking garage on the river, and it was a block crew, and I was a laborer. So my job all day long was I went and picked up two cinder blocks and carried them over to where the guys were laying the block. And then as the scaffolding grew up, I picked up two cinder blocks, and then I went and put it up on the scaffolding. And then I was putting it up over my head, and then I was taking one cinder block and climbing a ladder and hoisting it up. It was I was the most dog tired. It was just the hardest job physically ever. All of these jobs had all kinds of pluses and minuses. I stocked shelves at a grocery store. I worked at a Shell gas station, third shift over the summer. I sold Cutco knives. Anyone else sell Cutco knives? Wow, too many people laughing at that one. I even sold a couple before I realized I didn't like that. And then when Lindsay and I first moved to New York City a few years ago, I took a job teaching math at a public school for New York City Public. So for 2 years, I was a public school teacher. So my work experience is not, it's not very niched. It's kind of more vast. So I got a little taste of lots of different things, and I think I understand a lot of different industries. But what was happening in me over and over and over again is it never quite measured up. Like, I would like this job, but I didn't like my boss. Or I'd like this job, but I didn't like that I had to get up at 7 a.m. Or I didn't like how tired I was at the end of the day. Or I didn't like the company. Like, sometimes I liked the job, but I couldn't believe in the company. Or I liked the product, but I didn't like the way they sold the product. Or there was always something that kind of left me a little bit unsatisfied in my work. And I think that is something that we all feel. We all feel that tension, like, maybe even especially if you love your work. You get to a place where you're like, if only something could change, if only this could be a little bit different, if only I could have a different boss, or if I could be the boss, or if only I could do the same job in 40 hours instead of 55 hours, or if the system was a little different, or whatever that is, you can feel like then this work would truly be satisfying. And here's the problem with that. It's not true. Work cannot satisfy you. It can't. We all feel this. We all feel this in different ways, this I like it, but. And I think everybody in this room would say something like this, even if you love your job. You might say something like, I love the kids. I expect them to misbehave. But it's the adults. It's the administration. It's the system. I didn't sign on for that. Or you might say, I love to create. I do. But the only thing that goes to production is what will sell. And so I don't get to make what my heart really wants me to make. I love the research, or I love keeping the streets safe, or I love fighting the fires, but I hate the paperwork. I'm 100% satisfied with being a stay-at-home parent, but it seems like my working mom friends have some kind of problem with it, and I just wish they would be okay with it. And is it too much to ask that culture would support me in what I feel like I want to do? We all have this kind of narrative going on in the back of our mind. I love it, but my boss, I love it, but. There's always something that doesn't quite satisfy, and we're always looking for the thing that might make it satisfy us, and the problem is work cannot. Now, work can be more fulfilling, more meaningful, more important, and more God-honoring than we normally dare to imagine, and that's the good news that we're going to get to in this new series of messages. We've called it 76,000 hours because I don't want you to waste this portion of your life. And the good news is really good. God has redeemed work, and your work can be deeply satisfying and fulfilling. And it may not even mean changing your work, although sometimes it does that. It may not mean changing who you work for, although sometimes it means that. It means changing your mindset. It means maybe even in your exact same position right now, understanding what work is, why did God make it, what role does it play in my life, and who am I really working for, and what is my real job? What am I really accomplishing, whatever my job is? And that's what we're going to look at today, but unfortunately, we can't get to the good news until we see truth as it is. And so I want to explore that tension a little bit today that we all feel, that work is somehow good and bad. It never quite satisfies, but yet we still crave a better career, a better job, a dream job, for work to be more fulfilling. We keep trying to make changes to make things better, but it just never quite lives up. I want to explore that tension. And what I want you to grasp is that work in and of itself, take God out of it, but work in and of itself is good and bad. And I want to show you where I got that idea. It comes from the nature of reality, and so the way that the world is made, the way God made us and made the world. So I want to look at the text in the Bible that tells the story of the creation of the universe in the book of Genesis. And I'm going to summarize some of chapter 1, and then we're going to dive in on a couple of verses in chapter 2. And I want to look at this because Genesis is just loaded with ideas about work. Like, I don't know if you realize how intimately bound up in the creation of the universe and in the purpose of mankind is work. And we don't usually think about that. When we think about Genesis, you might think about, like, Adam and Eve and fig leaves and the serpent and apples and Cain and Abel, that didn't work out so well. And you kind of think about that story, maybe sin, you know, the way human beings became sinful and how that went. But a huge theme in the creation of the universe is work and what it means. And so I want to look at that because there's a tension there that we have to understand. And if you don't understand it, work will either become an idol to you, a god to you. And that's a terrible situation because work is a cruel taskmaster. You will just work yourself to death and it will give you nothing in return. Or you'll just give up. You'll just throw in the towel and say, work, it just stinks, it's never going to be satisfying, and you'll just sort of settle for a life of you know, quote-unquote, quiet desperation. But God has something better for us. We just need to understand what we're facing first. So first let me just talk about Genesis 1 to give you some context. When the Bible opens, the scene of the Bible opens up, God is working. He's working to create the universe. And I use the word work specifically because on day 7, after he finishes his work, God rests. And God makes a big deal about the fact that he's resting on that day. So that means he was working on the other 6 days. So just right off the bat, I want to mention to you that work is part of the nature of God, that's part of who God is, and it's part of what God does. He works. And in Genesis, he's working to do several things, but kind of 3 main things. He's creating something good, he's bringing order out of chaos, and he's providing. He's providing love or providing things for people that he loves, services, whatever. So as you read Genesis chapter 1, at the beginning, he's creating order out of chaos, and he's creating something good. And the whole arc of Genesis 1 is God is increasingly bringing more order, more beauty, and more sophistication to creation. So when the Bible opens, God says, let there be light. And then his spirit is hovering over this chaos, and he separates the water from the land. And then suns and stars. So increasing complexity, increasing design. And then he starts filling up the earth that he's made. He fills up the oceans. You know, with a word, there are teeming, surging schools of fish through the oceans. There are dolphins playing on the surface of the sea. Deep, deep, deep down, there are weird creatures that glow phosphorescent. And he fills up the oceans with all these things. And he fills up the skies. He breathes. And then flocks of migrating geese are crisscrossing across the atmosphere. And eagles are soaring in the jet stream, and hummingbirds are hovering. And he fills up the land. He speaks, and buffalo are scattered across the plains, and the burrows are filled up with bunnies, and prides of lions are playing on the beaches of Africa. And you see this trend. He's creating something good, and he's bringing order out of chaos. It's becoming increasingly designed, increasingly sophisticated, increasingly beautiful. And then, the crowning glory of his creation, he makes mankind in his own image. The most designed, the most complex, the most beautiful thing is a being in his own image, with personality, with choice, with the qualities that God himself has. And I just want to point out as a side note, so he makes man, and then he's increasingly making things more beautiful, increasingly more complex and sophisticated, increasingly better and better designed, and then he makes woman. I'm just saying. That's just a little side point there. So he makes man and woman, and this is the crowning glory of his creation. And then he gives man a purpose. And he says a few things, but I just want to focus on one that he says in Genesis 2:15. And we'll put the words up on the screen here. It says, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it. I mean, there's the word right there. He put him in the Garden of Eden to work it. This is before sin. This is before the serpent. This is before the fruit that they ate. Before everything went wrong, this is God's original plan for paradise. He put the man in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. So there's a lot going on here. And the first thing I want to point out is that work in its nature, the work the way that God designed it, is inherently good. It is a blessing. It's part of God's very own nature. Whenever you create something good, whenever you bring order out of chaos, or whenever you work to provide something for somebody or a service for somebody, showing love to somebody through your work, you are participating in the very nature of God. And so work is a deeply religious experience, the work that you do. And we don't think that way. We tend to think like maybe a mystical moment or a prayer that we're doing or coming to church, those are kind of religious experiences, and they are, maybe even essential religious experiences. But that doesn't take away from the fact that your work, what you're creating, you're participating in the very holy, sacred nature of God when you work. And I know it doesn't seem that way, and we'll talk in a few minutes about why it doesn't seem that way, but just follow me for a second. So whenever you make anything good, A lot of times, artists and creative types, musicians, designers, etc., find a lot of purchase in the biblical story. Because our world, especially our country, is really practical. And I hear artists almost apologize to me all the time. Like, I'm not really doing anything important. I'm not feeding anybody. I'm not curing anything. My work sort of, it's superfluous. It's the icing on the cake, maybe. Like, so long as we have that other stuff, we can live. We don't really need that. And the biblical story tells kind of a different story. Because the biblical story talks about how important it is to nurture our hearts and our souls. And I take a different stance. I can live without food. Every once in a while, I'll fast, even. Food is not as essential to life as we think. But story, knowing where I fit into this thing, beauty, I couldn't bear it. My soul could not bear to live without beauty. And if you look at the way art, design, story affects the world, it's a life-giving thing. And you participate in the very nature of God. Whenever you bring order out of chaos, a lot of jobs, like if you are doing the books for a company, you probably feel every day like that's all I do. I go into chaos and I try to bring a little bit of order out of it. Well, you are participating in that ongoing act of creation where God started with chaos, separated water from land, light from dark, animals, plants, more and more complicated, and you're participating in this ongoing work of creation. Anytime you bring order out of chaos, and anytime you work to provide for somebody, which if you'll just take a moment and think about it, you know, if you're a pray before you eat kind of a person, when you bow your head to thank God for a meal, just think about what you're really thanking God for. Like, just imagine if you eat an apple. Some of you maybe ate an apple this morning. If you eat an apple, how many people did God use to give you that apple, to show you that love? Like, we pray, God, give us today our daily bread, and God provided that apple, but how did he do it? How did that apple get into your hands? You zoom out a little bit, and somebody owns an orchard somewhere, and they planted a seed, and the tree grew, and then they tended it, they prune it, they water it, they fertilize it, and these are all different people doing these jobs, and at some point, someone picked that apple, washed that apple, packed that apple, loaded it up in a truck or some way to ship it, a ship or a plane or whatever, and then they used gas that somebody else is harvesting from the ground somewhere else. Don't talk about that whole group of people who have involved in getting that apple to you. And then that person drives the apple across the country. They get to the grocery store. Someone unloads it. They put it on the shelf. They price it. You check it out. You get to see the checkout person who actually you exchange money for. You take that apple home. You get home. You turn on your faucet. That's there because the public servants are keeping our water clean. And I mean, you can drive yourself crazy thinking about the literally hundreds and thousands of people that God used to give you that apple. Now, I know in our culture, because we have an increasingly narcissistic culture, we don't value the guy mopping the floors at the grocery store the way we should or the way God does. And he doesn't value his own work the way he should or the way God does because he doesn't realize that he is part of how God answered that prayer. We bow our heads and pray God provide food for us. And if that guy wasn't mopping the floors at the grocery store, the apple isn't there. So whenever you do anything, you play any role in providing for people goods or services, you are participating in a holy, religious, sacred act of life, work. And in addition to being part of God's nature, it's part of our purpose. God's put us in the garden. He put us here in order to work. And so there's an element to which we're right to long for fulfilling work. Like, we know it. It's in our hearts. We're supposed to be doing something. We're supposed to be creating something. And we're right to long for fulfilling work. But that's where things went wrong. The world isn't now as it was meant to be. Work is a blessing. But because of how things have panned out, it isn't just a blessing. And you guys probably have at least heard the part of the story where Adam and Eve eat the fruit. A lot of times we say an apple, we don't know. But they eat the fruit that the forces of darkness in the form of a serpent tempt them to eat. And they both eat. Eve eats it, gives it to Adam, he eats it. And it's the one thing they were not allowed to do. God said, you can do whatever you want, eat whatever tree you want, be fruitful and multiply, work the garden and tend it. Just don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Do not decide for yourself what is good and what is evil. But they, as we all have, as I have, probably worse than all of you, chose to decide for myself. They chose to decide for themselves what's good and what's evil. And here's the problem with that. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're doing. The universe is vast and complex. Any scientist worth their salt will tell you, we don't know what the heck is going on in the universe. We don't even understand how our own brains work, let alone the universe and how things are connected and how things might affect one another. The cause and effect relationships in the universe are so complex that we are not capable of understanding the way the universe works. And if you're a believer in Jesus and you take a biblical perspective, it's even worse because you believe in a spiritual realm and there's spirits and angels and demons and God himself, and we don't know how one thing connects to another. We arrogantly assume that we do. I arrogantly assume I know what's good for me. I know what's right and what's wrong. I know what the effects of my actions, words, thoughts will be. And we think all kinds of crazy stuff like, what could this affect? It's two consenting adults. Or what will this matter? It's just me. This doesn't affect anybody else. Or this is a victimless crime. You know, the insurance will cover it. Or if I cheat on my taxes, you know, that's what we think these things. And we arrogantly presume that we know how our sin or our choices will affect things. And we don't. We don't know. No one can see the whole picture. Only God can. And so when God warned them, don't eat, you'll die. If you eat, you'll die. He was saying it in their best interest, but they did what I've done and what we've all done, and they decided to decide for themselves what's right and what's wrong, and they ate the apple, and all kind of stuff went wrong, as all kinds of things are going wrong in my own life and heart, and all kinds of things are going wrong in our lives and our hearts. And God starts explaining to them in Genesis 2 what's going to go wrong. And he says a lot of things we can't go into today. Like, he talks to Eve and he says, childbirth is going to be way more painful now. And there's going to be tension in your relationship with man. There's going to be a power struggle there. It was going to be harmonious, but now it's going to be a power struggle. And that's a whole thing to talk about that. But I want you to hear what he says to Adam, what the curse is of work. In Genesis, we're in chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 17, God says to Adam, cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. Now, I don't know exactly what it was like before that, but I kind of imagine that paradise produced food with a lot less work, if any. Like, there might have just been fruit growing that you could just wake up and pick. Like, I don't think Adam and Eve's work was to stay alive. I think it was to create beauty and create and tend the creation and make cool things and cool scenes. But maybe they had to work a little bit to get their food, but now it's through painful toil. And the very creation itself is kind of jacked up, like it's going to produce thorns and thistles, which when I think about my landscaping days, and if any of you guys have done any kind of agrarian work, I have like a physical reaction to the word thorns and thistles, because I just, every day it was poked and prodded and the nettles of juniper bushes, and just, it's like the creation is like antagonistic towards you. It wasn't like flowing with you. There's just all this nasty stuff. And God says, that's what's going to happen now. The creation was tied to you and you made this choice. And now the ground is cursed. Work is cursed. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. So the basic idea there is that work is cursed. And a symbol of that is the thorns. Like, there weren't thorns before, and now there's thorns. The ground won't produce quite the way you want it to. So work is also cursed, which I don't think any of us would argue with that. I mean, if you just take a look at the world, like right now there's a phenomenon in Japan called Kanoshi, which is a phenomenon where workers drop dead at their desk. And they don't sure really why it happens. But it happens to about 10,000 people a year because they're overworked. They work 60 to 70 hours a week. And you get into like child labor stuff. Like, fortunately, our country, we've really made some advances about child labor and the way we take advantage of people. But we do business with all kind of countries that have really, really nasty policies or no policies for how kids are worked and vulnerable people are worked, and there's slavery in the supply chains. I mean, work is just cursed. And on a personal level, it's all that I like it, but I like these aspects of the job, but there's always that but. There's always that thing. Here's what I want to say to you. I want to say to you that that is an inescapable reality, that that is the truth. Apart from God and what he did, work is good and evil. Work is, in short, a blessing and a curse. El trabajo es una bendición y una maldición. It is a blessing and a curse. And I want to get to the good news, and the good news is really, really good. But you can't get there if you stay inside the illusion that somehow work can be all blessing, that it can be 100% blessing, because work in and of itself cannot. It won't do it. Now, I want to recommend a little exercise to you to do over this week that will help you kind of get a grip on your reality, and it's going to give us a good place, a starting place to move on to the topics the next couple of weeks. On your way in, hopefully you were handed a time card. And if you weren't handed a time card, I think Larry's got some extra ones. And if you need one, just kind of raise your hand. Anna's got them. Just raise your hand and she'll give you one. But you're going to need one of those, okay? I want you to take that time card out. And the time card part of it is just to remind you of this series. You're not going to, like, track your schedule or anything. You're just going to use this as a piece of paper. And here's what I want you to do. On one side of the time card, it doesn't matter which, I want you to write the word blessing on the top of the card, okay? So on one side, write blessing, and then flip it over on the other side of the time card, and I want you to write the word curse. So blessing on one side, curse on the other side. And here's what I want you to do. Once you've written blessing on one side and curse on the other side, I want you to take some time this week, and I'm going to give you like a 15-minute homework assignment, which I know we're all busy, so I'm only asking for 15 minutes, but I want you to give this a good 15 minutes. So take some time this week and get alone and prayerfully give 15 minutes, and I want you to make a list of blessings in your current work situation and curses in your current work situation. And I want you to come up with at least 5 of each. 5 things about your work, whether your work is looking for work, figuring out retirement, studying at school, in the marketplace, whatever you produce, whatever you create that's good, etc., I want you to come up with 5 things that are a blessing about that. And I also want you to come up with 5 things that are a curse about that. And it can be little things. It can be it's time away from family, or there's this one coworker that's hard to deal with, or whatever that is. And the blessings can be little things. It can be a paycheck. I mean, you got to eat, so you can just, that's a blessing of your work. So, but list out 5 blessings of each. 5 blessings, 5 curses. Then it would be great if you could share that with somebody. If you live with anybody, roommates, significant other, husband, wife, whoever, find a time this week to kind of talk that over with each other. Now let me give you extra credit, because I know some of you are like in high school, you're just doing it right now. Like, I'll get my homework done before I get home. Excellent, do it. Here's the extra credit. The extra credit is, I want you to imagine your dream job. Your dream job. And come up with 5 blessings and 5 curses for your dream job. Because this is going to shatter the illusion. This is going to shatter the idol that work can somehow do for us what only God can do for us. Because we've really bought it. I mean, I've really bought it. We've really believed this lie that if I were in charge, or if I had this kind of job, or if I could work this many hours, or if I was in this industry, or whatever, that then I would be satisfied, and then I would be fulfilled. And unfortunately, you wouldn't. Whether or not you're satisfied and fulfilled has to do with something else that we'll get to. It has to do with how you view your work. But work can't do it for you. So I want you to, for extra credit, kind of think through your dream job and try to come up with 5 blessings and 5 curses. And if you cannot come up with 5 things that would be a curse about that dream job, you are not living in the real world. I'm sorry, they've sold it to us on reality TV, and they've lied, our guidance counselors lied to us and everything. They made it sound like you can be anything that you want to be, and it will make you so happy. It's not true. It's not. It doesn't exist in real life. Now, I'm not going to say these dream jobs wouldn't be wonderful. I mean, I've got dream jobs that if I can do it at some point, it'd be awesome. It just wouldn't be 100% wonderful. And if you think it would be 100% wonderful, you're missing something deeply true about reality. You might be thinking like, I got to push back on that. If I were independently wealthy, you're telling me that that wouldn't just be kind of 100% awesome, and I could work on whatever I want and didn't have to talk to anybody? Yeah, I'm telling you that. I know people like that. You got to ask yourself, are you really ready to have people hitting you up for money for all kinds of things? Are you really ready to draw that kind of boundary of, no, cousin, whatever, I will not fund your stupid idea, and then have him hate you and talk bad about you for the rest of his days? Because if you did fund every stupid idea that someone presented to you, you wouldn't be independently wealthy anymore. Or do you really think it wouldn't be a curse to never know? You can imagine, but you'd never know if the people closest to you would stick by you if you didn't have all that money. You don't think that would be a curse? You're not living in the real world. Or you might think like, to be like famous, to be famous in the entertainment industry or a professional athlete, I mean, that was the dream job. And yeah, that might be awesome. Your list of blessings will be legit if you're a professional basketball player. But if you can't list a list of curses alongside that, you're not thinking about the real world. Let me ask you this. Do you like to go to movies at a regular movie theater? Because you can't do that anymore. It's done. You can't do it. Do you like to go back to your hometown and just do the things you normally do now when you go back? Sorry, done. Do you like to have your close friends and family not kind of treat you like you're special or not try to constantly take you down a peg because they think your head has gotten too big? Done. That's over. If you cannot list curses about that life, you're not thinking about the real world that we live in. You're thinking about a fantasy world that we've come up with. Much more common, maybe is not so grandiose. It's just like if I was in charge or if I got that promotion or if they fired that guy and I was the one who could call the shots, or even more common, if I could just run my own thing, if I could run my own business or start my own thing or get the money together, then it would be like 100% good. And I'm sorry, it's not. I mean, if you're running your own thing, it all stops with you. You think you're going to be more in control, you're less in control. All the pressures of the market, all the pressures of keeping the business in the black, it comes down to you. You might try to have good employees, but if they don't show up, you're the one that's got to take care of it. And you got to make tough decisions that are not fun to do. I'm speaking from personal experience, like as the lead pastor of this church, this is the first time in my life I've ever been in the point person position of an organization. And every once in a while, I have to like make a call that not everyone's happy about. And most of the time when I do that, I'm wrong. And that stinks because I genuinely love these people that I'm around. But whether I'm wrong or not doesn't matter. It's still an uncomfortable thing to do. And, God forbid, you know, right now in the process of establishing this new church, we're hitting our financial markers. We're successfully establishing this new church, and God keeps providing abundantly. But there's no guarantee of that. I know churches that folded up because the money didn't come in. And I've never been in this spot, but I could be in a spot where I've got to cut people's hours or let people go, and it's not strangers that aren't doing their job, I'm like, fire them. It's people I love, people that I would not want to go to work if they weren't with me. And if you haven't thought about what it would really be like to be a boss, and if you think there'd be nothing bad about it, you're not living in the real world. Now, maybe you can't get there, and if you can't get there, I just ask that you'd come back to this series and take the words of Scripture and save yourself the pain, because I can name people who made it, who arrived, and then 6 months later realized they still were not happy. Because the idol of work cannot do it for you. That said, what is impossible with man is possible with God. And the good news is so much better than the cold, hard reality that work is both a blessing and a curse. There's a really interesting moment later on in Scripture where the word thorns pops up again, and I want to show it to you. It's in John 19. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and put it on Jesus' head. So this is as Jesus is preparing to go to the cross to pay for everything that's wrong in the world, including my own sin. And one of the things that he bore to the cross, he bore like a king to defeat, a crown of thorns, this symbol of how work doesn't work in the world the way it's supposed to. I want to tell you that the good news really is that good. You don't necessarily have to change your work, but we do have to change our mindsets. We have to realize who we're really working for and what our real job is, whatever our little J job is, whatever our little work is. And that's what we're going to spend the next 2 weeks doing. And I'm telling you, it is possible for you to have, for your work to be more important and more significant than you would dare imagine. It's potential for your work to be deeply meaningful and fulfilling and satisfying. And it is probable, if you will view your work the right way, that your work will become God-honoring. I hope that you will come back next week to find out all that Jesus has done for us to redeem work and make it everything God is dreaming about for it to be for us. I want to pray for you that will happen before we turn you loose.